Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast seeks to bring together the worlds of academia and professional practice. If you're interested in the latest research and trends in sport, then this is the podcast for you. Today, I'm with some of the world's leading experts in preparing athletes to perform in the heat. Dr. Lee Taylor, Dr. Ben Stevenson, and Professor Sebastian Rassani are here to discuss beating the heat, with a particular focus on the Tokyo 2020/21 Olympics and Paralympic Games. In this podcast, you'll hear about the changes the Tokyo Organising Committee have made to specific events in preparation for the anticipated high temperatures. Our guests explain why these changes are necessary, describing the thermoregulatory responses of the body when we exercise in the heat, using specific examples from Olympic and Paralympic athletes. You'll hear about the importance of preparing for the heat in advance before finally learning the gold standard techniques, as well as some repeater approaches that athletes and coaches can implement to help them beat the heat. Hi everyone, thanks for coming to the podcast.
Hi Martin, thanks for having me on.
Hi Martin.
Today we're going to discuss beating the heat. So a specific focus on Tokyo 2020/21, looking at the Olympics and Paralympic Games. But before we do, can we have a brief introduction from you guys? So Lee, starting with yourself.
Yep. Hi everyone, my name's Lee Taylor. I'm a reader in exercise and environmental physiology at Loughborough University. Prior to that, I was based at Aspetar as the head of research operations. I'm a practitioner and researcher. Predominantly, my research focuses on training and competition in the heat for elite athletes. I'd assume that's why I've been invited to contribute today.
Certainly is, definitely is. And Ben, can you just introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Name is Ben Stevenson. I'm currently a research associate at Loughborough University in sports science. Prior to that, I completed my PhD at Loughborough, part of which was around thermoregulation and preparation for the heat in Paralympic athletes. And I'm currently working as a physiologist for the English Institute of Sport. So primarily working with Paralympic triathlon, paratriathlon, but also working on some project work around preparing other Paralympic sports for the heat of Tokyo.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ben. And Seb, yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sébastien Rassiné. I am the head of research at Aspetar, which is an orthopedic and sport medicine hospital. And I have been working in the area of heat and how elite athletes can prepare to the heat for a couple of decades now. And I'm also the chairman of the IOC working group in preparation of the extreme weather condition for Tokyo.
Brilliant. Thanks for your intros, guys. It certainly seems like we've got the experts that we need to tell us about this subject. So, Lee, just to set the scene, can you just set the scene regarding Tokyo 2020/21 and why it's so important that we're looking at this heat situation?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple to set the scene. And given the delay in Tokyo, it's become even more prevalent and more of a hot topic, pardon the pun, that we're expecting for the majority of events, it's likely to be the hottest and or most humid modern Olympics, Summer Olympics in history. So there's been lots of conjecture and talk about this. And we've seen some changes in the schedule and the events because of this. Some unprecedented countermeasures have been employed. For example, it was really high profile that we saw the road races, so the marathons and the race walks, relocate from Tokyo to Sapporo in an attempt to find more temperate conditions for the athletes in those races.
What kind of conditions are we talking about in terms of temperatures, humidity?
First, I would like to clarify that even if we are talking specifically about Tokyo today, I think that everything that we will say may be relevant for future Olympics also, because Tokyo will be the hottest Olympics in the history, I would like to add, so far. Because clearly, that's a concern that may come back in the coming years for two reasons. The first one is that the sports scene is getting more and more worldwide. So there is more and more events being organized in South America, in Africa, in Asia, for example, in China, or in Middle East. And the second reason is that the temperature have also increased, even if it's just a couple of degrees, but have increased across the last decades. And there is also the calendar that is becoming more and more congested. So this is not the first time that Tokyo is welcoming the Olympics. There was the Olympics in Tokyo in 1964. But even if none of us were born in that time, in 1964, the Olympics were in October. This time, they are in the normal period of end of July, early August, due to the congested calendar for most sports around that Olympic period. So there is a range of reasons that make the condition of Tokyo, even if they are the hottest so far, likely to happen again in the near future.
I think it's a really good point, Seb, and something I was going to pick up on the end is, I imagine, hopefully we can reflect upon this podcast and what happens at Tokyo 2021 for the Qatar World Cup for football and have a conversation about that at another point. So it's a really good point. When we talk about the temperature, what temperatures are we talking about that we're expecting at Tokyo?
So obviously the temperature varies during the day and from day to day. But the organizing committee of Tokyo 2020 has done an awesome job in recording the WBGT on every single venue of the Olympics on every day of the Olympic period since 2017. So they already recorded 2017, 2018, 19, and 2020. The WBGT is a kind of a global index that means wet bulb globe temperature. It's a kind of a global index that is used by several sport institutions as well as by the army or some in occupational setting as well to quantify the level of heat stress. It measures in a single value, it gives you an idea of the temperature, the humidity, the solar radiation, the wind flow, and so on. And in Tokyo, we can expect that from the early morning at 8 o'clock, you will have a WBGT of at least 25. And in the middle of the day, in some of the venues, some of the days, we will have a WBGT higher than 32. What does that mean? If we look at the American College of Sport Medicine and their recommendation, they generally recommend to stop any sporting activity above 32. It's what they call a black flag.
Okay, so we'll look out for some of the changes you're going to speak about shortly, but thanks for clarifying that exactly, Seb. So, Lee, you mentioned a few changes. Ben, is there some changes that have come about in terms of power rule changes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as Lee mentioned, like, it is going to be the hottest Olympics to date. And it's the same for the Paralympics. So the Paralympics, yes, they're a few weeks later on in the year. So temperatures are cooling down slightly as they go into winter in the Northern Hemisphere. But it is still a significant challenge during the Paralympic Games window as well. So I think generally there's been a lot of good work done by the organising committee just around the Paralympics in general, in terms of making sure venues have shade, there's enough fluids available to athletes and spectators and staff. There's a lot more first aid and first aid trained individuals at venues. There's been a lot more education pushed for athletes and spectators as well as to the risks of the heat and how to prepare for it. But looking at a sport-specific level, sport that I work closely in is triathlon, and World Triathlon have done a really good job. They've made some specific changes to their rules. So they're allowing athletes to wear cooling garments, things like ice vests, up to pretty much the start of the race, which they haven't done previously. Normally, athletes would have to line up and be paraded somewhere between half an hour to an hour pre-race, and that was that. You had to wait on the side of the course until the start of the race. Now, athletes can prepare and cool down properly up until pretty much the gun goes. They have provided more aid stations on the course. They've provided coaches areas on the run course where coaches can pass fluids or cooling items to the athletes. And they've actually allowed things like ice boxes in transition so athletes can store a cold bottle or some ice packs or whatever it might be in transition so that when they come out of the swim or come off the bike, they can actually grab something cold in the middle of the race, which again is all really helpful. And fair play to World Triathlon to being pretty proactive to some of the concerns raised by nations.
And is that kind of thing happening across the board in different parts of the event? Are these people working together? So, Seb, have you got examples of this where the actual event is being changed, the specific event, due to these conditions?
Yes, there is actually a few examples, both at the level of the International Federation and at the level of the IOC in cooperation with the local organizing committee. So, for example, for triathlon, the starting time has been advanced by 1 hour in order to minimize the level of heat stress during the race. But this is the case for a number of sports. For example, in rugby, where it was games that were meant to be held both in the morning and in the late afternoon, the one of the morning were scheduled a bit late morning at a hot time of the day, so they have been advanced earlier in the morning also to try to minimize the environmental heat stress. So at the end of the day, every single sport and every single venue have been reviewed and in order to look at the specific cases. So for example, another one that is coming in mind is a mountain bike. The cross-country mountain bike course has also been slightly postponed in order to do not start too early in the afternoon. So several decisions have been taken in order to minimize the level of heat stress on the athletes.
Brilliant. It's brilliant that they're taking this into consideration. But why do they need to consider this? So what challenges are there for athletes and how does the body respond to heat?
That's a very good question. And indeed, we should start by that. So it's not really how the body responds to heat, because the common view is that the heat is a problem by itself. But we should be considering that an athlete is different than somebody at rest. An exertional heat stroke during an activity is a different mechanism than a passive heat stroke that we will observe in vulnerable population. The main problem of the athlete is that he's producing the heat himself or herself. When you exercise, the muscle is producing heat. The efficiency of your muscle is only around a quarter. What does that mean? That means that 3/4 of the energy that you are using when you exercise is becoming heat, and only a quarter is becoming movement. That's roughly the same efficiency than any machine, than your car, your fridge, your computer. Any machine has roughly an efficiency of a quarter only. In your car, the heat is produced at the level of the engine and is dissipated in the environment in front of your car at the level of the radiator. And the heat is carried by the cooling liquid. In an athlete, the radiator is the skin and the cooling liquid is the blood. So your bloodstream will carry the heat from the muscle producing the heat to the skin where it will be dissipated in the environment. If the environment is cold, this dissipation can easily happen, for example, by convection, by having a cold airflow going on the skin. But if the environment is hot, the heat dissipation will be much difficult. And then when you are in a hot environment, the only way for an athlete to thermoregulate is sweat evaporation. And that has two consequences. The first one is when you sweat, you are losing fluid. And a lot of people are talking about dehydration in the heat. The second one is because you are losing only a little bit of heat when you are in the environment due to the environment being already hot and humid. That means you need to send more blood towards the skin. And everything going to the skin is not going to the muscle. So you cannot exercise at the same intensity. But I don't want to enter too much into detail, but also everything going to the skin is a bit in a dead territory and will not participate in the ventricular refill in the same way that the blood going to the muscle. That means that you will have a decrease in the ventricular refill, so decrease in the stroke volume. And to compensate a decrease in the stroke volume, you need to have a higher heart rate. So at the end of the day, for even quite a relative low exercise intensity, when you exercise in the heat, your heart rate will be much higher. Or if you are an Olympic athlete, for a given heart rate, because you exercise at the maximum of your physiological capacity, your intensity will be slower.
So, but there's special considerations for different athlete populations. So I know in one of your papers I've looked at, you've talked about athletes, you've talked about untrained athletes, but also what about males and females?
So there is indeed a lot of things to consider. And for several decades, we have considered that females were having maybe a disadvantage when exercising in the heat as compared to male. But it turned out that it is actually not the case. And most of the difference that we observe between male and female can generally be explained by anthropometric differences. And the latest studies that have tried to control for different biometric factors conclude that actually the thermoregulation is quite similar between male and female. There have been some minor differences, but they are very minor as compared to the effect of heat on the human body and on the athletes.
Ben, what about power athletes? Because I know there's a lot of work that you've done around power athletes and the difference between the athletes. So can you enlighten us a little bit on that?
Unfortunately, there just isn't the amount of scientific literature to back up what the differences are and how, and to quantify it and say what the magnitude of impairment is for para athletes. But realistically, there are certainly factors we need to consider looking at para athletes, and that's probably across most impairments that you might see from athletes at the Paralympics. So probably the most studied is athletes with a spinal cord injury. So athletes, if they have a complete spinal cord injury, so a complete lesion of the spinal cord, below that lesion, they cannot sweat. So that's a big heat loss mechanism that Seb just mentioned that is taken away, really. But not only that, but they can't vasodilate, so they can't enlarge blood vessels towards the skin to lose heat that way as well. So there's almost two big heat loss mechanisms that are impaired for spinal cord injured athletes. So that's probably the most studied and most well understood, but pretty much every other para athlete has something to consider. So athletes with a limb deficiency, especially probably lower limb deficiency, they're probably seeing a lot more inefficient movements. So as Seb mentioned, you're probably 20% efficient human, average human. That's probably even less for limb deficient athletes because they have coordination differences, they've got asymmetries in locomotion, but also wearing things like liners and prosthetics. That's a big area of your body that is unable to lose heat through evaporation or convection because you're wearing a 5mm polyethylene liner, whatever it might be. But also athletes with a intellectual impairment or brain injuries have issues with pacing, so potentially might not be able to regulate their intensity of exercise in the heat. And even things like visual impairments, so physiologically they're probably very similar to Olympic athletes, but if they don't have the cues as to how much they're sweating or what the colour of their urine is, they might not understand the level of dehydration, which again is a huge risk factor for heat-related illnesses. So pretty much across the whole para athlete spectrum, there is differences, and they will increase the risk of heat illness and heat strain.
Thanks, Ben. I know we've touched on it, and we can go on about individualism across Olympic athletes and Paralympic athletes. So it's good to have that brief insight of individualism. If we just move on and talk about events, because obviously we're talking very broadly about Olympics and Paralympics, but there's a variety of different events, whether it be sprint events, intermittent events, or endurance events. So Seb, can you just give us some examples of any of those type of events and how those specific events might be affected?
Sure. So the common wisdom is to consider that the longest the event, the more at risk it will be. But this is actually not necessarily the case, because as we mentioned before, the problem of the athlete is that he's producing the heat himself or herself. So that means that shorter events have generally a higher intensity, and a higher intensity means a higher metabolic heat production. Just to give you an example, we did some recording during the Cycling World Championship, and we could see that the temperature reached by the cyclist during the time trial, that is an event of 40 to 45 minutes, was actually higher than the temperature that they reached during the road race, that is an event of around 3 hours for the woman and 6 hours for the man. So you don't need to have an event of several hours to be at risk. And a very good example is actually the 10K. So the 10,000 meter on the stadium is a pretty short event. It's below 30 minutes. And despite that, athletes will reach very, very high temperature because the metabolic heat production will be very elevated. So you don't need to consider only the very long event. You should consider also the middle duration. Then there is a question about the very short event, for example, the sprint, the jumps, the throws. And even if the athlete may consider that a sprint below 10 seconds will not be affected by the heat stress, the athlete will be, because he's not in Tokyo for 10 seconds. He's in Tokyo for 2 weeks. Before the event, he will be training in Tokyo for 1 week to 10 days before the event. During the training, he will be affected by the heat. If he's not acclimated before to travel to Tokyo, he will have to acclimate once in Tokyo. And that's a problem, because normally the last day are your taper period. If you acclimate, this is a source of stress. So you don't want to add that on your last day before the event. So even power athletes will need to prepare for the heat before to be in Tokyo. Plus, before a 10-second event, you also have a one-hour warm-up where you will increase your temperature. I think that Lee may comment on that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, like, the whole paradigm of different events within the Olympics and the dynamics as well. And I think the organisers have done a fantastic job in the main, moving things to make life easier for spectators, athletes, and the practitioners. I think one of the events that really interested me for a long time is rugby sevens, because you have multiple challenges to heat balance during the day. So, for example, the matches themselves are very short. They're only 14 minutes, 2 7-minute halves. And if you look at some of the data for the world, the HSBC World Rugby Sevens Series, so that's one of the qualifying events for the Olympics. And we've managed to collect some data from both the girls and the guys regarding their core temperature responses across the day for multiple events. And if we consider any core temperature in excess of around probably 39, 38.5, 39, we're probably going to have a reduced ability to execute repeated sprints. We saw from our data that both the girls and the guys in relatively modest conditions, so even as low as 18 WBGT, they were approaching this threshold where we see compromised repeated sprint ability just in the warm-up. And they transition from the warm-up very, very quickly into the match itself. So in these temperate conditions, some of the athletes were reaching or exceeding 40 degrees C, and that's in less than 14 minutes match play, and you're doing that 3 times a day. So not only do you have the leading phase to any power or sprint based event such as the sprints on the track and field, but you also have these highly intermittent short events. So rugby sevens is a prime example, but we also have field hockey, soccer, and those sorts of things. So we need to consider the intermittent athletes as well. And there's multiple logistical and competition factors that prevent you from doing exactly what you want to do with these athletes, because you only have limited time. So yeah, it's a real challenge for practitioners.
So with that challenge to practitioners and athletes, who's at the greatest risk then of heat illness, heat stroke around this?
Yeah, I think it's multifactorial, because there's so many things that contribute to that risk. We have the event itself, the weather conditions, the heat acclimation status of the athlete, and their prior incidents of exertional heat illness or heat stress. And these things change minute by minute, hour by hour, some of them with the weather conditions. And if you're within a game, the physical demands of the game can change as well. You might be expecting only to play one half in a rugby sevens competition, but someone gets injured and you have to suddenly double the physical load that you're expecting. So I tend to think of it quite simply and rely on the conceptual heat balance equation and basically thermodynamics. The longer you're exerting yourself, the longer you consume oxygen, and that's the thing that's inefficient and why you produce this byproduct of heat. So those long events, if you can't appropriately thermoregulate, are going to be very challenging to those athletes. So if the ambient air temperature around you is hotter than, say, your normal homeostatic core temperature, or about as hot as you're going to get in that event, so 37 to 42, whatever may be, you're going to struggle to utilize your thermoregulatory mechanisms to remove this excess heat. But the real challenge comes when the air around you is completely saturated with water vapor, i.e. it's very humid, because we know when we're exercising at a high metabolic rate, if the air is temperate or at least around 30 degrees C and dry, so there's limited humidity, we're excellent sweaters as human beings and we can liberate that heat very quickly. But if we see conditions like we're expecting in Tokyo, where it's going to be hot and humid, or like we saw in Doha 2019 World Championships, where it was very humid, the air is so saturated with water, sweating becomes redundant. So we can lose up to the high 90% of our excess heat through evaporative heat loss. But when that's compromised, it makes sense. If you're doing a long event, consuming lots of oxygen and generating lots of heat, and you can lose no heat, you're essentially acquiring heat stress and heat load within the body until either you reduce the rate of the activity, so you reduce your pacing, or you engage in some form of strategy to reduce or limit that rise in heat, or at least make you feel perceptually better. So certainly the long events, if it's hot and humid, they would be challenging. But also, as Seb nicely articulated, with the power events, if you're leading phase and your warm-up hasn't been done appropriately and you're just not doing things right, your performance can be compromised. And also for the intermittent sports that I discussed, especially those with repeated bouts within the day. And we also may see repeated track and field type events in the day as well, repeated sprints or throws. And even worse than that, if it's hot and humid and you're a power athlete and you've already got compromised whole-bodied wettedness, you're compromising yourself even further. So you just quickly acquire this heat and it's hard to liberate it. And really one final thing, bringing it back to the influence of sex. Whilst everything Seb says is true, one of the fundamental issues in general, total body mass and heat storage capacity of females is a lot smaller than males. So if you imagine a kettle of water, if it's a third full, it boils much more quickly. If it's full, it takes longer. And it's the same premise with athletes. If you've got a 56K female rugby sevens player, she's going to get hot much more quickly than a 100K male rugby sevens player. Conversely, it's much easier to cool this player because there's less heat to remove from her, whilst the big guy is going to store a lot more heat and take a lot longer to cool down. Hence why the big guys tend to sweat a lot longer after the competition.
Interesting. Good insight. Nice. Really nice insight. Ben, I saw you nodding there when we're talking about power athletes. Is there anything to add in terms of who's at greatest risk there?
I think Lee put it very, very well. So when we look at it from a power athlete perspective, it's exactly the same principles. It's the duration of the event, the duration of the outside in a potential Tokyo environment, but also the intensity of exercise. They're the two probably first areas we'd look at when we're stratifying risk across the power athletes. And then, yeah, as we mentioned before, there's undoubtedly impairment-specific considerations that are going to increase the risk of thermoregulatory strain. So as we mentioned, spinal cord injury is a big one. That's probably the most severe impairment from a thermoreg perspective, especially if it's high level and there's a big area or big body surface area that can't sweat, that can't lose heat through evaporative processes. That's a huge risk. But sometimes, as probably alluding to Seb's point, it's not really just the constraints or the dynamics of the sport that we need to look at. It's everything outside of it. So you're going to be in 2 weeks, perhaps. And if we take potentially a sport like boccia, that's an indoor sport. During competition, there's no real risk. There's going to be an aircon facility. That's fine. But if they're milling around outside in the village, going to and from the food hall for potentially half an hour at a time, in a sport like boccia that has very severe neurological impairments, all of which are going to have very different responses to the heat. Some can't sweat, some can, some are very heat sensitive. It's not just what's happening in competition that we need to consider. It's everything about being in a Paralympics environment. So what is the temperature on the shuttles to the venue? If you're going from the Paralympic village to competition venue and it's not air conditioned, you could be in a pretty hot and humid environment for a prolonged period of time with an inability to lose heat. So I think very much just building on what Seb's point was, it's looking beyond the what the event looks like and considering the whole 2 week, 3 week window of the Paralympics.
Seb, did you want to come in there as well?
Yeah, I just wanted, even if it has been mentioned both by Ben and by Lee, to clarify that we are talking about events being at risk, but there is never a certitude in the sense that it depends on the individual as much as on the events. And you may have two athletes looking the same, having the same body size, body weight, practicing the same sport at the same intensity. One of them will cope very well with the heat and another one will struggle. So it's good to consider the event because this is where we need to put our resources, both from an organization point of view in terms of facilities and heat depth for treatment and so on, and from a training perspective or federation perspective. But we should also focus on every single individual, and there is several factors that we can act upon. We know, for example, that heat acclimation, and I guess we will talk about that a bit later on in this podcast, but heat acclimation is very, very important to protect the health and the performance of the athlete. So when you ask which athlete are the more at risk, rather than to give you a sport, I would like to answer the one who are not prepared for the heat. They are the ones the most at risk, whatever their sport is. And then there is a few other contextual factors also that need to be considered by the team doctor and the athlete once in Tokyo. So, for example, we know that Lee mentioned that an history of heat illness is a risk factor. But there is also some immediate risk factor. So somebody who has suffered some recent infection or a recent diarrhea or even a vaccination in the days preceding the event is at higher risk of heat illness also. So there is a lot of things to consider at the level of the individual also.
It's really interesting. I've done lots of podcasts with lots of people. And so recently we did one with Penny Briscoe, the director of sport for the British Paralympics Association. And she talks about wanting to be the most prepared team at the Paralympics, massively spoke about individuality. Every single coach that we've spoken about with SNC or anything always talks about the individual, the athlete. And I think the real importance about coaches knowing athletes, you know, cannot be understated. We can have a lot of data, but knowing your athlete is key to a lot of these things. Just to slightly go off the topic for athletes, obviously we're all hopeful that there'll be spectators at the Olympics and there'll certainly be a high number of staff at the Olympics. What kind of policies and changes have been considered for those people? Because it's still going to affect them, being out in the heat.
You're right. So actually, quite a few things have been planned for the workforce and the spectators also. So we not have been only working with the athletes. So for example, for the workforce, they receive some specific training on heat illness because they will generally be the first witness of a heat illness in the spectators or in the people in the street. So most of the volunteers will receive a training on how to recognize heat illness. They will also have water and bottle of water as part of their uniform, and they will receive various goodies in order to help them to cope with the heat. Same for spectators. A lot of things has been done for spectators. So there is, for example, on the website, there will be on the portal a specific information about how to cope with the heat in Tokyo. There is some specific cooling spot in what we call the last mile. So the last mile just before the security gate on any sporting venue. This is where the people gather, where you have a high density of spectators. So there will be special action and special facilities available there on the last mile. There is a good that will be done for spectators. The drinking fountain have been counted on every single venue to make sure that there is enough water available. And maybe the biggest change that has been done in the rules is that the spectators will be allowed to bring their own bottle with them in the stadium. You know that is something that is generally forbidden, both at the Olympics and in most international events, for a mix of security and marketing reason. And for Tokyo, the spectators will be allowed to bring with them the stadium fountain available for free refill of the bottle in the stadium also, to make sure that every spectator have access to hydration on the venue. But it's not only on the venue, it's also on the way to the venue. Because if you know that the security will take your bottle when you enter the facility, you generally come without a bottle. That means that the 2 hours that you have queuing at the stadium and coming to the stadium, you will not drink. By this kind of measure, we are expecting that it will improve the wellness of the spectators.
It'll be really interesting to see on the sport management sponsorship side of things about that. not to touch upon now, but it's an interesting conversation either way. Thanks for that, Seb. Let's move it forward and have a look at, so we've looked at the preventative things that the organisation can do and the preparation around that, but what can the athletes and the coaches do to prevent or help during events? Lee, have you got any insight for us on that?
So shall I talk about sort of the long-term and short-term approaches about the Olympic preparation phase? Would that be good?
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, so I think it differs and you have that individuality regarding sports and the athletes themselves within a sport. But I'll talk about the classical marathon runner in the heat example, where you, how you want to prepare them and what long-term and short-term strategies you can engage with. So those countermeasures to limit the performance decrement due to the heat and protect the athlete health as well. So classically, everyone on the podcast will be thinking and listening to it will hopefully be thinking about heat acclimation or acclimatization. So acclimation is a artificial process of becoming tolerant to the heat, whereas acclimatization is more natural in a hot environment, i.e. spending a few months in Tokyo before the games. And that is really the gold standard long-term approach, that your athlete regularly engages in activity of a sufficient intensity and duration to elicit sweating, increases in body temperatures, and the thermal sensations and perceptions of that thermal discomfort. And through that process, they elicit a whole variety of thermoregulatory adaptations or heat acclimation adaptations. And they, the simplest ones are resting and exercising core temperature and heart rates are reduced, an increased sweat capacity, so total body wettedness, and an increase in plasma volume, so almost your reserve of sweat capacity that's increased as well. They're the simple ones. I'm sure there's many more that we can talk about. But having those prior to competition is essential to being able to compete at the, give your best performance in the heat compared to your best performance in a temperate environment. They'll never be identically matched, but you can limit that reduction by being effectively heat acclimatized. The real challenge is that most athletes have to go through a period of qualification or competition prior to the major event itself. So the Olympics this year is the marquee event, and it's obviously a very different year with the COVID pandemic. But generally, it's a congested period of preparation, competition, recovery. The longer the event, the less competitions you'll generally have. You might only have one or two. If it's something like soccer, you've got a whole domestic season to go through and then prepare for Tokyo. So getting that long-term heat acclimation strategy correct is the best thing to do. And generally, you'd do that early in the season with a large block of heat acclimatization early in the season. Top that up regularly, correlated to your performance, and engage some re-acclimation, because it's really important to understand that if you're effectively heat acclimated early in the season, the amount of resource or time you have to invest in that again to become re-acclimated is reduced. It takes longer at the beginning, shorter to become re-acclimatized. So your long-term strategy is heat acclimation, understanding just how hot the event could potentially be. So preparing for the worst rather than hoping for the best. And if we assume most athletes will arrive at the games thoroughly heat acclimatized, we can engage in some short-term strategies as well, so race or match day strategies. And these principally concern pre, during, or post-event cooling. So with pre-event cooling, so this could be ice vests, cold water immersion, ice slurry ingestion, ice towels, cold air, wetting the skin, a whole host of measures, you're essentially trying to reduce the core body temperature prior to the event to give yourself a greater core temperature heat sink within the event, i.e. you can gain more heat without compromising performance. And that's quite difficult to action, and it needs to be really well piloted away from competition so you don't elicit any unwanted effects. So GI distress from excessive ice slurry consumption, numbing of the feet affecting pacing, these types of things. And that's really important to ensure that if you're engaging in quite aggressive pre-marathon cooling or race walk cooling, you need to be able to pace yourself by your watch rather than the feel until the effects of the pre-cooling wear off. And you see quite often there's been some problems with people not really piloting their strategies as well as possible. And during the event itself, it's very difficult in most events to physically cool somebody. You can only really temper the rising core temperature or make someone feel better. So that's a mid-cooling approach. So that could be ingesting ice slurry, pouring cold water on yourself. At the IWF World Champs in 2019, we saw some quite innovative headwear from the German team. They had a Legionnaire's cap, which they just filled with ice. There was a whole host of ice socks. There were some quite innovative measures to try and engage in mid-cooling. And importantly, that checks the rise in skin temperature, but it also helps people feel better, and perceptually that is a good thing. So really, to be prepared perfectly, you probably want to start a long time in advance, engage in a good solid block of heat acclimation, have a strategy in place to regularly top that up throughout the year to your gold standard competition bouts, and then have a really well tailored menu of pre-cooling and mid-cooling strategies you can engage with prior to the race or the competition. The main challenge of executing a good heat acclimation block at the moment, nobody can travel. So if you're here in the UK at the moment, you've got no access to a natural hot environment, and you can't, obviously in the UK, and you can't travel there. So it's very difficult. Also, there's only a limited number of heat chambers in the UK, and we can't physically get in some facilities within the UK and the Republic of Ireland. So it's very challenging at the moment, and there is some practical strategies we can engage with. But even if we didn't have the COVID pandemic, it'd still be challenging for half of the world going to Tokyo from a cool environment. And on top of that, you have access to heat chambers, those resources, fixture congestion, injuries of athletes, willingness of athletes to engage and use heat acclimation appropriately. So it is very difficult. The answer is very simple: long-term heat acclimation, match or race day cooling. But to get that over the line with every athlete in every discipline is quite challenging. And I'm sure Ben is facing that challenge at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I won't say too much about some of the strategies that we have done in triathlon. I think if we do another podcast after the games, we can show off a little bit as to some of the work. Hopefully, yeah, go into detail, but it's very much along the same lines as what you've just mentioned, Lee. But I can't go into some of the details on that one. But I think just listening to you two guys there, I've got a few questions that, from my personal experience, selfishly, I'd like to pose to you guys. And I think the first one would be, you mentioned around acclimation and using sort of artificial environments, whether that be heat chambers or, I suppose, hot baths or saunas or something like that, versus acclimatization and being outside. What do you think the benefits of those are? Would you recommend one over the other? Where do you guys stand? Because I know, Seb, you've done some research on acclimatization as well as acclimation.
Let's say I would just go back to a basic training principle. And this is also the language that the coach are speaking. And generally, when you discuss with a coach, you will talk about the specificity and the generality of some of the training. And what is true for training is true for training in the heat. So if possible, my favorite is generally heat acclimatization. So training in a natural outdoor environment. Because in addition of the physiological adaptations that you will also get with heat acclimation, training in a laboratory, you will also get perceptual adaptation. You will be used to exercise in this environment. You will learn how to cope with the environment, how to pace in this environment. So same as for any training, I would say the most specific is always the best. But the best is sometimes the enemy of the good. And unfortunately, a lot of coaches or athletes will not do anything because they cannot do the best. They say, oh, you said we should be doing that. We cannot, so we don't do anything. And that is really the worst attitude that you can have. Anything that you do in the heat will be beneficial. Maybe you cannot access or you cannot travel to a hot country due to the lockdown, as Lee said. Okay, then exercise indoor. Maybe you don't have access to a hot room, an officially hot room, where you can control perfectly the temperature and the humidity. Okay, just build one. Put a heater and a pan of boiling water in a small room and exercise on a turbo trainer. That will do the job. Maybe it's not as fancy and as ideal as going in a sport institute, but this is better than nothing. Generating heat is very easy. Simulating altitude is very complicated. But generating heat is very, very easy. So there is no excuses for a coach or an athlete to don't implement a heat acclimation procedure before Tokyo.
Liam, have you got something to add to that?
Yeah, just related to that, like excellent points from Seb and Ben. There's a really close to home good example of just how simple it can be to prepare for the heat and what happens when it goes wrong. If we look at Callum Hawkins from the Commonwealth Games, winning the marathon by an absolute mile, but unfortunately came down with exertional heat stroke and was pulled from the race, and it was quite harrowing scenes. To remedy that, his solution was buying radiators from the supermarket down the road and training in a shed in his garden in Scotland somewhere. And then he comes fourth at the IWF World Champs for the marathon there in a world-class field in some of the most challenging environmental conditions I'd ever seen. Seb and I were fortunate to do a research project there. And I think on one of the days it was 32 WBGT, not a breath of wind at 30 minutes past midnight in the morning. So he's gone from collapsing at the Commonwealth Games to coming fourth in probably the most challenging environmental conditions he's ever run in the space of not too long a period, with some radiators from Tesco's or Aldi and a wooden shed in his garden in, I presume he lives in Glasgow.
This example, there is a lot of example like that, and not only on people coming from what we could consider a cold country. So there is, I will not mention the name, but I have an example in mind of another elite athlete, one of the top worldwide athletes from an African country, who also collapse and was not able, whereas it was leading the African Championship. Then he just put a treadmill and a heater in a small room. He trained like that. And a few months after, he won the race in Osaka that were in conditions that were also incredibly hot and humid. So this is valid also for people coming from hot countries. They also need to prepare specifically to exercise in the heat.
Lee, can I just jump in? You mentioned some of the strategies that you saw in Qatar, sort of during the road race and marathons as to mid-event. Where do you stand on... is there any risk on some of the strategies that potentially might make an athlete feel cooler, whether it's some very localized cooling around head and neck or using methods like Menthol? And where do you guys stand on the risks associated with those type of strategies?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Seb and I have spoken about this quite a lot, especially when I was in Qatar. I think firstly, the safety perspective. It's a really good question, and I don't think people really know the critical answer of when you get that hot and you engage in that much mid-cooling, can it push you into an exertional heat stroke type event? One would assume that the redundancies within the body are so robust in general that you'd simply reduce the pace because you feel terrible and it wouldn't be an issue. I think mid-cooling strategies are certainly effective to offset the perceptual discomfort of being in the heat. If you look at maybe the strategy that Evan Dunphy, the Canadian race walker, engaged with, and the story I said about Callum was in the British press, so it's not public knowledge, and Evan shared all of his data all over Twitter as well, himself and Trent Stellingworth. He did a fantastic job. He engaged in so much cooling, and you can see he shared his core temperature from the race. It worked really well, and he came in bronze medal place. So it's certainly an effective strategy to slow the rise in at least skin temperature, probably core temperature if you do it enough. Menthol approaches, some of the data Seb and I are going to release soon show that they're not that popular within elite endurance-based athletes. Secondly, the only data I'm aware of from elite endurance athletes are some race walks, a paper from Chris Stevens in IJSPP, part of the Supernova project, I think. With menthol, I think if you like menthol mouth rinse and it gives you a good sensation, there'd be no harm in doing that after you finish the ingestion, whatever fluids you're doing, rinse the palate, that type of thing. The only issue I'd have with rinsing external skin with menthol is perhaps it could elicit vasodilation and compromise evaporative heat loss to some degree. And if it's a dry environment, not humid, you want to avoid any potential countermeasure that will reduce skin wettiness. Similarly, if you engage in really aggressive ice slurry ingestion prior to the race, you might compromise sweat onset for a similar circumstance. So I think within the races where you can wear an ice sock, ice in the hat, frozen hat, pouring cold water, the piloted dosages you can tolerate of ice slurry at race intensity at the given environmental conditions, I think they're definitely worthwhile engaging with. But they certainly wouldn't allow you to compete well if you hadn't engaged in heat acclimatisation, that's for sure.
I think you just hit the point, Lee, that was coming across to me there, that there's so many strategies with acclimatisation, but more specifically cooling just there. And going back to that individuality again, these athletes have to have practiced these things in good time prior to any event to know what works for them. I think that's a good message to put across on the cooling. Can we just touch upon hydration as well, please, Lee? Seb, go.
Yeah, just talking about individualization. So this is true for cooling, but this is also true for heat acclimation. You need to have an individual approach for heat acclimation as well. The way we were doing acclimation 20 years ago is not the way we are doing acclimation today. 20 years ago, most of our knowledge was coming from the military or from the occupational setting, mining industry. And then everybody was talking about 7 to 10 days. But since we have been doing a lot of study with athletes looking at individual responses, and it appears that what is true for workers to get an adaptation is not optimal for athletes who don't just want an adaptation, but want an optimal adaptation. And you realize that they may need longer than that. And you may take, generally that take around 2 weeks, but we also have made some study on the long term, and you realize that two athletes going through the same process, one of them may reach acclimation or a plateau in his adaptation in 1 week, another one may need 3 weeks to reach his plateau. So you need to individualize the duration of the acclimation also. And the only way to do that, as Lee said, is to do it a long time in advance. Because if you wait for 2 weeks before Tokyo, you have 2 weeks, no more, no less. So the only way to do that is to do it before, or at least 6 months before, to know if your athlete requires 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. A lot of people will claim that they can tell you that from some fitness parameter, blood sample, and so on. This is not true. There is no blood measure or no test in a temperate environment that can predict what will happen in the heat. If you want to know how your athlete will cope and will adapt to the heat, you have to put him in the heat. That's the only way.
That's a very good point. I suppose we could go down another hole there with the cost and, you know, athletes' funding and things like that, but I think we can leave that one for now. So, Lee, I think we're just going to talk about the hydration status and its effects.
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate, essentially whether to drink to thirst or to drink to a pre-formulated strategy. And it's really polarized across elite endurance athletes. You see some really good practice. Some of it's based on experience and piloting that. Some athletes will engage in no fluid ingestion. It really is markedly different between athletes. Personally, I think you go with what works for you and that you've piloted in the heat previously. If you've done something once and it works well, there's no point changing this within the event. It's too risky. You shouldn't be on the race morning deciding what and how much you're going to drink. And I think Seb's probably got something quite interesting to share on this from some of our recent projects or experiences together.
Yeah, we did some interesting observation with Lee during the Doha World Champ in 2019. And effectively, there is quite a wide spectrum of strategy across athletes. What was interesting is that we even saw some athletes who increased their body weight. So that means that they managed to drink more during the race than they were sweating. This is obviously not a strategy that is recommended because we know that the body can cope with a bit of dehydration, especially because that will happen progressively during the race. So if you start the race well hydrated, you tolerate to dehydrate progressively during the race. But we saw in a couple of athletes that they drink more than they sweat. So it was probably for perceptual reason and so on, but I suggest that they did not have a plan based on their experience in the heat. So this is quite a poor strategy in race, and it was at the level of a world championship, unfortunately.
And is there, in terms of hydration, is there a specific kind of drink? I know so this argument that we're talking about hydration, I know has been inflated by, potentially by sports drinks companies and that kind of thing. But obviously sodium is, you know, has a big factor to play. So is there any specific drinks that people should have? Or again, are we just talking individualized?
I'd certainly say individualized. Ultimately, you want to be consuming carbohydrates and electrolyte during the race to keep things very, very simple. I actually think that's a whole nother podcast, drink to thirst or a plan, and the probably composition is of that drink during elite endurance performance. Something, someone like Lewis James and Steve Mears would be great to do a podcast on that.
Let's go there with that one then. So let's move things forward. Obviously, we're in COVID at the moment. It has, or what effects has COVID had, I suppose, on any of this, particularly around all these gold standard things and heat acclimatization? Has there been any effects from COVID? We've already spoken about the problems from traveling and people not being able to travel and therefore heat acclimatization. But is there anything else that's affected this?
I think the inability to travel is a major obstacle for most federations based in a cool current climate, or if generally all year round their weather conditions are pretty temperate and don't get above 22-23 degrees C. Most federations and podium performance programs in the UK currently wouldn't be in the UK, or they'd be heavily engaged in laboratory based type heat acclimation, and to certain degrees traveling is essentially not happening. And there's limited access to those laboratories, because even if you've got the resource in place, the available resource is probably halved, because you need time for the respiratory droplets to clear. The room needs to be aired out. So there's real logistical and technical challenges to exposing your athletes to a hot environment. Many athletes are now home-based as well. So certainly from the athletes I work with and talk to, lots of people are engaging in pre-warming before they do their endurance events, modifying a room in the house to be hot, or post-exercise hot water immersion or saunas or whatever it may be. And obviously there's a inequality to what facilities athletes have. If you're living a nice estate in the middle of the Republic of Ireland that's got a sauna and a steam room and a gym you can turn into a heat chamber, you're probably going to be okay and at a competitive advantage. If you live in the middle of London in a high-rise tower block, no matter how nice it is, you're probably going to struggle to be able to do that. Also, as practitioners, we want to be evidence-based, and there's very little data on practical interventions to aid heat acclimatization responses in a temperate environment. So wearing additional clothing, engaging in thermal exposures pre and post the training bout itself, and how the sort of almost we'd say in the UK Blue Peter type approaches, how they compromise the actual load you're trying to get into your athlete as well, and how that's affecting their recovery and illness risk and things. So it really is complicated. Even without COVID, there's only so many places you can go which have the best facilities. By traveling to somewhere irrelevant of COVID, you increase your chances of illness risk. The food quality might not be as good. The facilities might not be good. So it is a real challenge. And I'm sure Ben, being at the coalface of this, has been trying to work through these for months, and they keep changing week on week and county by county in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head there. There's just so much red tape at the moment. So as you said, normally we would be spending, I don't know, a good few weeks of the year out somewhere nice and warm, nice and humid, and acclimatizing that way. Around that, we would be in heat chambers. Obviously, some are accessible, but probably most aren't in the UK. So we've had to, get creative, go down some of the more Blue Peter routes. As Lee mentioned, we've got one athlete at the moment going through a bit of a DIY heat acclimation block, just because for her, it's pretty important for Tokyo next year. Again, alluding to that individuality piece. when chambers are available, and like I say, some are in the UK, it's logistics, it's how long between sessions we have to have, how many athletes we might have to have in at one time. So before COVID was a thing last summer, we might have 5 or 6 athletes in each chamber at a time. That's not just, it's just not possible anymore. So yeah, there's plenty of considerations. And from a para-specific point of view as well, we need to be conscious that probably more para-athletes are immunosuppressed. So actually their risk, or their risk to health if they do catch coronavirus is significantly greater than most Olympic athletes. So actually there's more athletes shielding, more athletes in a vulnerable immune system state that we need to be careful of. But we've got to put our heads together. We've got to find ways that we can get athletes in the best heat, acclimatized, acclimated state that we can for next summer, and we will.
I'm just aware, guys, that we're running out of time, really. With COVID, obviously the PPE side of things, are there any kind of concerns regarding that and face masks and things like that? Is that going to be implemented? Is it going to affect things for anybody?
That question is not only a question for the athletes. Obviously, in Tokyo, as anywhere else, the athletes, the staff, and the spectators will have to follow the local regulations, and that it goes beyond sport. So obviously, what will be done in Tokyo will be depending both in terms of protective equipment and in terms of quarantine rules, will be depending of the regulation in Japan at the time of the Olympics. So I'm not sure we can
predict the
modify
future.
That.
Yeah, it's a valid point. And I know we've talked extensively around the changes that have been made, the things that athletes and coaches and everybody can do. Is there education out there for staff, for practitioners, you know, for everybody? Is there education? Has that been ongoing for a while? And can we point anybody in the direction of some of this to get some more information?
Sure. So actually, the education of the athlete is something that is very, very important, because as we said, heat acclimation is not something you do on the last day. It's something you need to do in advance. So you need to have the in order to plan for that. And I think we international federations have been on board for a little while now. So for example, back in 2016, we worked with the UCI, the International Cycling Union, to release a leaflet that was distributed to all the national federations to prepare for the heat. We did the same with the former IAAF, now World Athletics, and we have been doing the same with the IOC. So there is an athlete portal that is called the Athlete 365. Available online to each athlete that include information about the Olympics. And a big section of it is on heat preparation. It's called Beat the Heat, and it includes various recommendations on what to do, how to prepare, either in advance or once in Tokyo, in order to cope with the heat. And we got some very good feedback from coaches and federation, and it seems that this leaflet has reached well the coaches and the technical staff of the federation, but a bit less the athletes. So now we are working on some videos that will be released on social media, on YouTube, and so on, with practical tips to directly target and reach athletes.
Perfect. We'll get that out when we release this podcast. We'll put some links to that out for you. The conversation has been brilliant. We've learned quite a lot about thermoregulation and how to beat the heat. Huge adaptations and the federations around this, and some great knowledge. It's really good information around athletes and coaches and what they can do. But if we could just wrap up, and you could just leave with one point that you'd like people to take away from this. Can you just give us that one summary point? Lee, what have you got for us?
Yeah, I think mine would be to understand the thermal demands of your competition. So understand the core temperature responses in the event. And now we're all engaging in practical strategies due to COVID, is to also understand the thermal response you can elicit to these Blue Peter practical type heat acclimation interventions. So you retain that notion of specificity for your training from a thermal perspective. That would be my big take home in the current climate.
Thank you. And Ben, what about yourself?
probably build on these and say, know your athlete. Undoubtedly, with a para athlete population, there probably will be some consideration around thermoregulatory function and risk in the heat. But know your athlete, definitely go through heat acclimation, acclimatization processes if they are at risk, and trial any cooling strategies beforehand, because there could potentially be some negative consequences for them in a para athlete population.
Okay, and then to bring us home, Seb, no pressure.
No pressure. That will also be heat acclimate. And it's true that there is logistical challenges, especially those days with the COVID. But it's also depending where you want to put your resources. Because despite the lockdown, most of the athletes and coaches in endurance sport still want to go for an altitude training camp. An altitude training camp will make you gain around 1% of performance. So that may be the difference between the podium and missing the podium in a normal condition. But in the heat will decrease your performance maybe by 15%. So this 1% that you will gain in altitude is totally unuseful. So to recover those 15% of acute decrease you will have due to heat stress, you need to acclimate. And people need to understand that the magnitude of the effect is so much bigger than any other intervention that they need to acclimate.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. I think our listeners will absolutely love the advice. And like I've said before, we will post anything on the press release and any links to anything that you've said, we'll put it on there for our listeners. But thank you. And hopefully we'll talk again soon after Tokyo.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Lee, Ben and Seb. If you want to learn more about beating the heat, you could check out a paper from Dr. Lee Taylor and colleagues in the British Journal of Sports Medicine titled Cooling at Tokyo 2020, the why and how for endurance and team sport athletes. For a more para-athlete focus, have a look at a paper from Dr. Ben Stevenson and colleagues titled Heat-related issues and practical applications for Paralympic athletes, Tokyo 2020. Or take a look at the book Heat Stress in Sport and Exercise, co-edited by Professor Sebastian Rassani. Thanks for listening. See you next time.